You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I am Coach Jen in Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Karen Chatton from Gardnerville, Nevada, and you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for April 14th. This is episode 3925. Good morning, Horse World.
Welcome back to the day before tax day. I don't know. Maybe I'm just completely out of touch with the universe, but I haven't noticed the drama that used to go along with April 15th. Oh my gosh, I've got to get my taxes filed. It's crazy. I don't have time to get it. I haven't done my paperwork. I haven't noticed that so much. Is it just me that I'm completely out of touch?
You know, I know the post office is telling people don't wait till the last day because we might not postmark it in time for you, even if you do drop it off in time.
Uh-huh. Anyhow, we're opening the show with a lot of whining. We need to take a deep cleansing breath.
Yes.
There we go. And any crazy cool adventures? Because this is the part of the show where we always do that.
Yeah, exactly. I have done a 50 earlier this month at the Nevada Derby. I did a 50 and it was a big ride. There was over 100 riders. It was an intro ride and they had like all the like seven distances altogether, a 25, a 50, a 65, a 75, and a 100. And so it was a pretty big ride, which was kind of nice. We used to always have big rides in the West region. So it's nice to see so many riders. I had a really great ride on Jovi all day, and we finished in the top 10, which was kind of a surprise because I started a little bit late because the starting line is like about, I don't know, a 15-minute walk from camp. To get, because you had to cross a highway. So they don't start you until you get over there and cross the highway. Yeah. So I was a little late getting out on purpose. And it worked out good. We had a really good ride all day. He did great. He finished with all A's on his vet card. So he's really come a long way. This was the fourth time Jovi's done this ride. This was his very first AERC ride 4 years ago.
Oh, really? Wow. So why did you start later? What was the purpose?
I didn't want to get caught up in a big group. There was between like 40 and 50 riders on the 50. And I just didn't want him, you know, now that he's learned, you know, what his purpose is in life, he loves being an endurance horse and he loves to go. So when he gets caught in a group, he either wants to catch up, pass everybody, or stay in front of them. And so I kind of mentally wanted to get him in his own little space and do our own thing, get in our own little bubble, which we kind of did. And so that makes for a really nice ride because then, you know, you're riding your horse and he's not being like focusing on just being like a fire-breathing dragon, like he has to catch up to everybody or he's got to go, 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 go. It's like, okay, we're going to go and we're just going to do our thing and be in our own little space. And we had a really nice time. And so I like when we get to do that.
Yeah, it definitely makes particularly the first loop of the race a lot less stressful. After you get to the second, third, whatever loop, then things can chill out just a little bit. But that first loop is, I always used to laugh when I competed Digels. If I can survive the first loop, I'll be okay. But surviving that first one.
Yep. Getting past that ride start. Exactly.
Because I couldn't fool him with the whole start later than everybody else. He knew exactly where the start line was. And as soon as he saw horses go in that direction, it was game on.
Exactly. Exactly. Once I throw my leg over, I need to be ready to go. We're not going to just fiddle fart around. It's like,
As soon as he saw other horses getting tacked up, You know,
oh yeah, were, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he saw everybody else is getting their saddle on. He's like, I'm ready too. Let's do it.
Exactly. And even though, you know, I was on the 50, I still had riders like camp next to me that were on the 100.
Yeah,
so they,
exactly.
They started and left earlier. Yeah. So, the horse was already up and ready to go.
Yeah, they always are. It's what horses do.
I know. We talk about it all the time, how much our horses love what they do, and they really, truly do love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds as if the 50 was the most popular division. Is that typical across competitors in AERC that the 50 is kind of the bread and butter?
I'm not sure, because this was also a dual sanctioned FEI ride. We had, you know, some of the riders that they're trying to qualify for the upcoming Worlds and other FEI events. So there were riders in the 65, the 75, and the 100. And so what they did with them, because the FEI rides, they need to be able to go fast, because they have a time element that's more important to them than to us AERC riders. You know, most of us on the AERC ride, we just want to finish in time, have a good ride, have our horse look good at the end. But the FEI riders, of course, they all want those things too, but they also need, in order to compete internationally on the global scale, they need to be able to go to courses where they can go faster. So they put the course for the longer distances on this ride on the side of camp where it was all good footing and mostly level flat. Whereas us on the 50, we had mountains to climb over rocks.
Yeah. Yeah.
and it was a little more, you know, of a technical, little more difficulty there as far as the footing went compared to the FEI courses. And so that way those riders could, you know, make the times that they needed for their goals. And it all worked out. I think everybody had a really good time, and the NASTAR club did a great job managing it.
Yay.
Yay.
Yay. And we would be remiss if we didn't get a quick Apollo update. So for newbies, give Apollo a quick introduction and let us know how he's doing.
Okay, so Apollo, he's an Anglo-Arab, and I sold him 2.5 years ago, which he's the only horse I've ever sold in my life, and I swear I'm never going to sell another horse again. Fortunately, we got him back. My friend bought him back, and he's back at my place, but he came back with like a 3 body score. He was literally starving. So I'm getting help from veterinarians, you know, the local vet, and then other endurance vet friends that we've also had on the show over the years for the refeeding and getting him brought back into condition. And, you know, it was really scary. We had no idea. He was so bad, he could hardly even walk. He was staggering, dragging his feet, and looked like a living skeleton. So he's been back, as of today, 3 weeks. And he's already looking a whole lot better. But, you know, we know it's going to take months to get him back to where he should be on the scale. His body basically cannibalized itself, and he's lost all of his muscle. So it's going to take time, and we're just happy that we have him.
I saw you had posted a couple of pictures of him, and you had taken him out for a little hand walk around the neighborhood, and he's starting to get a little sparkle back in his eye.
Yes, we're letting him, we walk him like a half a mile, let him graze for half an hour, and then walk him back home. And he loves it. He does not want to leave. He wants to stay eating all that nice, fresh, green spring grass. He's loving it. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's nothing that makes a horse happier than eating grass, does it?
And Jovi's mad. Jovi's like totally got an attitude about the whole thing. He glares, his ears are back, he's grumpy. He's like, Mom, I'm over here starving. You know, and it's like, Jovi, you vetted in at your last ride with a 6 body score. You are not starving.
Yeah, he is a little chunky monkey, isn't he?
He is. He's nice and round. And so
it's almost like the more fit he got, the heavy, he's like a bodybuilder. The more fit he gets, the bigger he gets.
Oh, geez, I know. Well, they become easy keepers. All my horses do. And it's like, that's why it's like so weird that I have this horse that's like half the body score of my endurance horse, you know?
Well, I think Apollo is a little bit different body type. He seems to be the longer backed, leggier sort.
He is, yes.
Yeah. Of the I remember
Anglo,
when you first got him, he was
thoroughbred.
Yeah, that thoroughbred really showed through with him. Yeah.
Yes. So his metabolism is different. You know, he has different needs. You know, he needs a lot of groceries just to maintain his weight.
Yeah.
Whereas Joby is what we call an air fern, where you just wave the hay in front of him and he gets really round.
Yes. I have two air ferns. Yep.
Yeah. So here I am, you know, we're feeding one like he needs, with tons of just small meals, really wet mashes. And, you know, and then I've got the others that basically I'm trying to limit how much they get because they're all very, very round. So
yay.
There's that. Yes. There's that. One extreme or the other.
There you go. That's what they do best.
Eat.
This episode is brought to you by Farnam and Endure Gold Killer Fly and Mosquito Control, a new fly spray for horses. Discover fly protection redefined with Endure Gold, made to annihilate flies, ticks, and mosquitoes with brand new EPA-approved ingredients never before seen in equine care. Endure Gold is backed by science and built for hard work, delivering fast knockdown and up to 14 days of fly protection. Add Endure Gold to your arsenal and upgrade your fly control rotation. So about this time in the show, we always have a little training tip from Karen. And for non-endurance riders, fear not, because these tips invariably apply to pretty much anybody. So what are we chatting about today and why?
Well, today we're going to talk about vet check planning. So I like to plan ahead as much as I can.
So
the
let's
day
start here.
Before.
Let's start here. Mm-hmm. For the uninitiated, what is a vet check?
So the vet check is you ride so many miles during the course of your endurance event, whatever the distance is. You know, like this last ride I did, we rode about 25 miles till we had our first vet check. But if you were doing, say, an LD that's 25 miles, you're going to have a vet check probably after 10 to 15 miles. So what I like to do the day before is get everything organized and pre-planned as much as possible so that when I come in during that vet check, whether it's in camp or an out vet check, all my stuff, all my gear is already ready and I have less stuff to do. So I like gallon-sized baggies and I will measure out the feeding. I always like to give, you know, a couple of different choices to my horse for food. So I'll put his food together in a baggie. If I want to add any salt or electrolytes, I'll add it and have it all together and then put it into a bucket. I don't usually add any water until I come in and then I add the water because you don't want stuff sitting out, especially if it's going to be hot. So I get everything sort of organized together. If I have a crew bag, you know, that's when I add the gallon baggies with the various feeds to go to the out vet check of feed pans and a bucket.
Let me ask a quick question here. So your little buffet that you create for your horse, are all of the buffet selections things that he typically eats at home, or are there little bonus things? How do you decide what to put in them?
Exactly. Every horse is different and they change throughout. I've learned this throughout their careers. Like 1 year, they might like a certain brand of feed. And then next thing you know, they won't touch it. So that's why I like to have a couple of different choices. And so usually it is what he's used to eating at home, but also a lot of that is stuff that he only gets when he's actually working, like on a long training ride or an actual endurance ride.
Got it. So there's no surprises, but there are different levels of yumminess and appeal involved.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So I usually also like to add in maybe a couple of carrots or an apple or two, you know, get everything kind of together, ready to go. So if I come in, I've already got a bucket of water ready to pour into the feed to make a mash. You know, the night before, you want to go over everything, make sure you know what the vet checks are going to be, your hold times, the pulse criteria. You know, you're going to kind of plan ahead as far as how do I come into the vet check? You know, am I going to get off? You know, once I see the vet check, some rides put a pie plate or a marker out like a quarter mile out. And so
so you can lead the horse in.
So you can get off, okay. You know, you can loosen the girth, pull your bit off if you're riding in a bit, stuff like that. That kind of helps get the horse to start recovering and dropping his pulse so that you can come in and get your pulse taken and be down right away because you have to meet pulse criteria for your time to start. So you want to come in and be down, you know, have your stuff planned. Are you going to put some water on your horse? If so, then you're going to want to have a sponge attached to your saddle so that it's quick and convenient to get to, or you bring a cart up to the vet check, or you have it in your crew bag, depending on, you know, the situation. So you want to get all of that stuff kind of organized and together ahead of time for not just during the ride holds and vet checks, but also for the finish. So you want to be able to come in when you're done, you know, you're going to go back presumably to your trailer, pull your tack, get your horse cleaned up, and then you're going to want to go vet because you have a half an hour to meet the pulse criteria. Now you have an hour to pass the entire vet check on a 50 and up. On the LDs, I think you've got to vet through within a half hour. But you do need to pulse down.
Let's just say that there's a lot of math. Yes. And for somebody who's not, I'm math disadvantaged. What I found really useful was to have sort of a schedule in there. And I attached it to, I had a crew box rather than a bag. But I had it attached there because in the heat of the moment, because I didn't have a crew. I was doing LDs and 25s. I didn't need a crew. But for me, the thing that disappears first when I'm stressed is my ability to A, read, and B, do math. Those things just go away. So I had to have it all very carefully written out and generally color coordinated in giant letters. Because if I have to feel like I'm hurrying, I screw it all up. So yeah, pre-planning is really key there. And it's really hard because if you're new at it or you don't do it very often, each ride is just a tiny little bit different.
Right. And here's another tip that I've been doing, especially now as I'm getting older, is I look at the ride map ahead of time and I see what the colors of the loops are. So if, for example, the first loop is pink, the second is orange, and the third loop is blue, I write P-O-B on the top of my hand with a marker.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so you can't lose that.
Exactly. So if I'm out there and there are loops intercepting and sometimes the trails will have a common trail amongst two loops or three loops, and then you're going along and now you realize you're on blue, but it's the first loop, you should be on pink, I can look at my hand and go, uh-oh.
I
ended up just following footprints or another horse in front of me that might have been on a different distance. And so I need to pay attention. And so that's something I've been doing lately is writing the abbreviations of the colors of the loops on my hands in order. And so that kind of helps keep me on track so I can't goof up and do something stupid.
There you go. So whenever you crew or whenever you do a vet check that has a vet check where it's tack off, how do you deal with making a heap with your tack somewhere? Do you have something that you hang your tack on? Do you just pile? How does that work for you?
Right. Some rides will put down a tarp for people to pull their tack and place it on. Other times, most of us will bring up a little cart. Like I have a little kind of a wagon cart that I'll bring up and I can
like a
put.
Beach wagon. Yeah.
Yes, I put my little buckets and feed pans and feed and a handheld heart monitor, a sponge, you know, anything that I think I might need for me too as well. You know, you want to also plan to take care of yourself, you know, with snacks, food, refill your water bottles, stuff like that. And so I'll bring that up to the vet check. It just kind of depends. Some rides, it's more convenient to just go to your trailer to do it. And other times, if it's, you know, if it's going to take you, you know, 5 minutes to walk to your trailer each way, and you've only got a half an hour hold, and you still have to vet in, then you're better off planning ahead and just pulling your tack when you know, come in if yeah. that's going to be required. Usually they don't make you pull your tack for a shorter hold. You know, it usually needs to be 45 minutes to an hour or at the finish.
Yeah. And that's something that, again, because the majority of competitors at any given ride are people who have done it before, you have to raise your hand a lot at the ride meeting. And just ask
questions,
ask questions, because a lot of these tiny details that are key to not only finishing, but also to reducing the amount of stress that you have during a ride are just skipped completely or kind of glanced over. So somebody who is new to the sport and doesn't have a built-in support system of someone who is familiar with it, I would encourage you to raise your hand a lot. Or even better, just at the end of the meeting, just go find one of the organizers and say, excuse me, I have about 45 more questions. Because that was a real eye-opener for me, is during the ride meetings, how many details they didn't even bother to talk about, because 85% of the people in the room had A, done a million rides before, and B, done that exact ride 25 times before that.
Right.
And each ride is just a tiny bit different. So unlike most other equestrian sports where the rules are exactly the same at every single show, it's a given what's allowed and not allowed. Whereas in endurance, it has to be able to morph depending upon how many organizers they have and the exact situation of that ride, because there's so many things you can't control in endurance.
Right. Yes, the trail.
The very nature of the sport, that's part of the game. It's part of the sport is being able to adjust to the exact situation of that ride, that year, that day, and still have a successful outcome. It's part of the game. So if you're used to riding in competitions where things are very precise, if you're coming out of the dressage universe, for example, it'll be a little bit of a learning curve, and you have to get comfortable with doing that. Well, that's very interesting and being able to be organized like that. That's, like I said at the beginning of all this, these things apply to all sports. That kind of level of organization allows you know, if your prep ahead of time is very precise and very organized and covers a lot of scenarios, the fact that you might have to change things later on is actually going to be easier.
Right. You know, and I know you've seen my setup at a ride where my horse has like two or three kinds of hay, you know, three kinds of mash.
Yeah.
He's got his sweet water and he's got his plain water. And it's a whole smorgasbord.
Yeah. And it was funny because when I would compete with Nigel, who at home, he's one of those Hoover horses. He'll eat anything. He's a great eater. And being a thoroughbred, that's a good thing because he needs a lot of calories. But at a ride, he was a very fussy eater. So a lot of the things that he was perfectly happy to eat at home, he wouldn't eat at a ride. So I had to do a lot of experimenting and bring a lot of things that he didn't necessarily eat a lot at home with me. Because that was the only place I could test it.
I know, that's the thing. You know, you can practice all day long, but in actual competition, things are can be at a completely different level, just mentally for the horse.
Yes.
And you. Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I have a terrible time. If I was the horse, I would get a poor vet check card because I didn't want to eat anything. I'm that kind of human at a ride. And you're right. So again, when you take your horse away from home, sometimes there are certain things you can only practice by going away from home.
Right.
And speaking of going away from home and having all the right things, let's get Kristen from the Distance Depot on and hear about what sorts of electrolytes, because that's something every rider needs to have when they go away from home. See what kind of things she's got.
Well, good morning, Kristen. Thank you for joining us. I'm looking forward to talking about our topics today, electrolytes and probiotics. So tell us what you got.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me. We have quite a variety of electrolytes. We have economical buckets or tubs in 5 and 4 pound containers that you can scoop out and dose yourself into. We sell the 60cc syringes, and we also have 200cc dose syringes and 70cc dose syringes. The bigger ones, the 70 and the 200 dose syringes, are dosing guns, so they have a really long plunger and a long tip, so it makes it easier to get it into the horse's mouth, and the tips are metal, so the horse can't bite them and break them. So that's kind of handy. And the 200, of course, holds a lot of electrolytes. It is a little more difficult to squeeze, so your hand has to be, you know, either really strong or bigger. The 60cc's are probably the easiest. But again, we have those powders. One of them is a Perfect Balance electrolyte made by Peak Performance, and it's sugar-free. So if you have a horse with issues with sugar, that's certainly a good one, and you're not wanting to put too much sugar in there. That's an excellent electrolyte. And then, of course, the other bucket is Enduramax. It's very salty. That formula has been used in endurance for years and years. And then, of course, we have the easy tubes that you can carry in your pouch if you're not wanting to make your own. We have a Light Now paste in 80cc tubes, which is 3 doses, and then we have a 1-dose tube as well. Those are fast absorbing and a really nice electrolyte, and easy to carry in your pouch. We have the Enduramax Plus paste, which is a buffered electrolyte, so a little buffering for the stomach, because when you're doing a lot of miles and you're giving a lot of electrolytes, that buffer is really nice to have, just because sometimes it can upset their stomach. And, you know, a lot of horses hold that electrolyte in their mouth like, oh, I'm not going to eat. Uh-huh. So that buffer makes it nice. But it's a really good electrolyte, too. And that's a 60cc tube, 1-dose tube. And then the Perfect Balance no sugar electrolyte, we do have that in the single-dose tube and a triple-dose tube as well. And, again, those are sugar-free. So some good selections there. We also have funky unicorn electrolyte treats, and those are little tablets, and you can buy them in pouches. There's a 3-pack variety, and you can buy them in a 7-ounce pouch or the larger 21-ounce pack, and you can feed those, you know, just during training rides or at the barn if you're not wanting to give sugary treats, and it will just help your horse drink more water, which is what we're after anyway. And then last of all, we have the Redmond products. And I know, Karen, you use the Redmond products. Lots of people do. We have the crushed loose mineral salt and rocks on a rope. We have the big rocks that you can put in a bucket. And those blocks, if you will, or rocks, they have so many more minerals than that little tiny block you buy at the feed store. I think those have around 11. And these Redmond rocks, I think they have like 64 different minerals, and they're mined right here in Utah. So pretty cool product, and horses love them.
Something else I want to mention. I noticed it again the other day when I was at one of the feed stores. We have 7 different feed stores within a 20-minute drive of us. It's a hard place to live, Ocala. Yep. Be very careful when you buy, if you're going to buy one of those square blocks at the feed store. Mm-hmm. A lot of them contain sugar and preservatives, or sugar, right. I was really surprised. I went to buy one day, and I got it home, and it was a different shade of red than the ones I used to buy back in the day. So mm-hmm. I looked at the ingredients, and it had molasses in it.
Oh my gosh!
Which You know, it isn't great for any horse, but if you've got one that has sensitivities to sugar, that's just the worst thing you can do, because not only do they not need the sugar, they're going to want to eat more of it because of the sugar. You know, kind of a never-ending circle there. So I'm also a Redmond Rock user. My horses all have a rock and a rope.
And I used to break them. I used to break them up with a hammer and put them in the dish. And so when I put their food in there, you know, I just called it pushing a rock because they'd push it out of the way, you know. But I know they were getting salt off of that because I fed my food most of the time wet.
Yep.
So I know they were
slush it around.
Salt off of that.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The young horse I have is very mouthy, very playful, just into mischief all the time. And the rock on a rope is nice because he can also zhuzh it around like a toy. It hangs there like a like the chew toys do, and he just zhuzhes it all around, and it whacks him in the head, and he just thinks that's the best.
And I guess last but not least, we have the Daily Gold, and that's a stress relief product, and it comes in a 4.5-pound bag, and that's made by Redmond as well. So it has that natural healing clay in there. Great for stomachs and when your horse is under stress.
Well, how would somebody get in touch with you, Kristen?
Well, they could give us a call toll-free, 866-863-2349, or visit us at thedistancedepot.com.
There we go. Karen, why don't you introduce us to our guest?
We have AP Davis joining us this morning, and AP is an aspiring Tevis rider. So we're going to talk a little bit about Tevis, Jeepers, the endurance horse that's going to be going to Tevis, and a little bit about AP's work. So welcome and good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Well, give us a little bit of background on yourself. Tell us a little bit about your work, where you grew up, and then we'll launch into the more important stuff about Jeepers.
Sure. Well, for my work, I have an extremely long answer. I wish I could be one of those people that just has a one word. Like, I'm a plumber. I'm a director and storyboard artist for animated comedy and TV and film, which means I draw cartoons. But due to the nature of my industry, I'm unemployed for months between productions. So I'm also an influencer, a barn manager, and occasionally both my horse Jeepers and I work on set. So I'll work as a wrangler and he is an animal actor. And we mostly do commercials. Everyone wants to call him a movie star. We are, if anything, F-list celebrities. He is not a movie star. We do commercials. But I'm from Auburn, California. My family's from Auburn, California. My family has a long history of like coming over to California like during Gold Rush era, and has mostly been around Northern California, even though I did grow up military, not being in the military, but being a military kid. So my family moved around a lot. And if my dad got orders or was deployed somewhere, there really isn't a lot of places to call home. You end up in a random location and you don't know anyone and you don't know your neighbors. So I'd often end up back home in Auburn. So for me, even though I didn't have a consistent timeline of growing up there from being born there to going to high school, I always came back. And that's why I'm so connected to Auburn, California. But for those of you who don't know, it's the endurance capital of the world. And that's the finish line for Tevis. It starts up in Tahoe and it finishes in Auburn. And grew up on my grandfather and grandmother's ranch there. So we would board horses. Everyone around us was into endurance. So for me, I have this big connection that it's a place that I get to go to escape everything else that's happening in the world. That's my home base.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about Jeepers.
He's a quarter horse. he's 15 years old. You know, everyone wants to think I have this phenomenal, extraordinary horse, and I absolutely do. But he's nothing like, I didn't get this horse that's bred to do amazing things and has this incredible bloodline. I don't even know what it is. But I think this horse is incredible because I love him so much. It doesn't have anything to do with what his intended purpose was, but it's because I've always believed in him. We've been able to do incredible things. Like, I've had this horse on Hollywood Boulevard for a red carpet premiere of a movie. And I've walked him up the stairs, which I guess you're not supposed to do, of the Griffith Observatory. And now he is conditioned up to, we're going to do Tevis this year. And I got all 300 of my qualifying miles within like 5 months. So I genuinely think like he's a ranch horse, but the reason why people love him so much and they connect with him, because through my influencer stuff online, I show how much I love him and what he's capable of. And he is kind of an underdog. Like, people believe in him. They like to see a horse that isn't your typical Arabian that was made and bred to do endurance. They see a horse that is fully capable, because all of them are. Like, just a few exceptions, most horses can do this. They like to see that you can take this horse that you love so much, pretty much your backyard pony, and you can condition them up to be an incredible athlete. And, you know, people also love to see him hamming it up and working on set. People like to believe that their favorite animal can do the exact same thing that Jeepers is doing.
He's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
You got to give him. Yeah, no.
He does have that. He is very handsome. That's why he works well on camera.
Yes. Okay. So what motivated you originally to want to do Tevis? I know you've been a Tevis sweep rider. So yeah. is that what, you know, once you did that, did you just fall in love with the trail? Tell us about that.
Well, I've always been involved in some capacity. I've also been a volunteer. I've been crew for many other riders, and there's just so much magic in being involved in any capacity. And it really is the crew and the volunteers that make the whole thing go. It's something that I've heard at Tevis forever. People always say the easiest part is riding it. And that does sound ridiculous, especially if you can't fathom riding 100 miles through that kind of crazy terrain and elevation change. But it's true, because all you have to do is ride your own ride and keep going. But the thing that makes Tevis so incredible is that you have like 900 people show up to create this event that to keep the riders safe. We're tracking them everywhere they go. We're making sure the horses have what they need at every vet checkpoint. There's even volunteers who are making like hamburgers and hot dogs at Forest Hill, which is like the 68, 69 mile mark, for other volunteers, for anyone who gets into camp. And my whole hometown really comes together for this event. So my love for Tevis isn't just, I think a lot of people see it and they see this big challenge that they want to do. And I see it as like, this is a whole world of, it's a whole community. And to me, it genuinely is magic that you can take these trails. I've ridden a lot of them because it is in my hometown, and the Western States Trails is what we have access to, and it's beautiful land, but you can just ride those trails. It doesn't make it Tevis. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it at all because you don't have any of the safety measures, but technically, again, not saying you should, technically you could just do Tevis. Like, you could just start up in Tahoe and you can finish in Auburn. And that's not what makes it the ride for me. So the appeal of it is that there is just so much energy and magic in the event itself that it is something that I've always wanted to experience from the perspective of the rider. Most of the time that I've been involved in Tevis, I just did not see it possible for me, because I saw a lot of people who had more means than me and had nicer horses than me. And I saw people who were like training for years with expensive trainers. And I didn't really realize that a lot of it was just time. I mean, there's a money factor in it too, but it was a lot of time and work. And I was just seeing the end result. I see people who had all these incredible things like nice rigs and nice horses and nice tack. And they didn't start there from day one. So I never thought that it was possible. And it took more of a push from people around me in my community to be like, you could do this. Like, your horse is fit. Mm-hmm. You have the drive to do it. You absolutely can do it. So for me, it was mostly being encouraged by others around me that it's not like you're just born one day and you have a specialized saddle and fancy horse. Like, everybody starts somewhere.
Exactly. You know, and a lot of people, they just start out, you know, on a shoestring budget. And I know that's getting harder and harder, especially for those of you that live in California right now with the fuel prices right. And stuff. It's a challenge. But I'm so glad that you made this your goal. So tell us what your conditioning plan is like.
Well, right now I've been very lucky that one of the elements of pushing me towards Tevis was I came to work on an endurance ranch as a live-in barn manager, which is where I am currently. And the owner of my barn has a program for all of her endurance horses that it was so easy for me to just squeeze in and follow it. But a lesson that I learned from her was previously I was just... Again, I didn't know how people even got there because my starting point of knowing anything about endurance was Tevis. So that's like if you were learning about swimming from being at the Olympics. You never, ever saw anyone like just step in the pool for the first, do their first backstroke. You're always seeing who are at the top of their game and have their horse conditioned all the way at the top. So my thought was like, well, I just have to start riding long miles. And I originally started doing that when I lived right up against Griffith Park in LA. And I would just take my horse out and I would do, and this is probably going to make all these endurance riders cringe, but I would do 25 mile rides every week. And I would do like 5 to 10 mile rides like every other day. I had this loop up in the mountains that would go to the Hollywood sign and come back down and around Griffith Observatory. And that was a good 20, 25 mile loop. And I had recently learned from moving to an endurance ranch that it's not the quantity of miles, but the quality. I don't have to be doing that kind of conditioning. And that's also how people lame up a horse. So a lot of what I do is like, here I have this incredible machine I call a blender, and any horse person knows it's a hot walker. It's called a Eurosizer. You put all the horses in, you press a button, and they walk around for a couple of miles, which is amazing when you have work and other things to do that you can't always be riding horses. And we also have a great training hill, and that goes back to quality and not quantity, that doing that hill work and increasing which muscles the horse is using, it is way more important than just going, like, even though that's a 5 mile ride or so, the quality of it is incredible to build up your horse. So, right. And currently I have him conditioned so well, and we've done so many of these 50 mile competitions. My focus is like a few times a week, we're trying to build up his top line. So I'll go up a hill and I'll just kind of push his head down and push this is me explaining. I'm used to explaining to people how horses work, and you guys know, like, he sucks in his gut and he pushes into the muscles in his back and he builds up those muscles a little bit more because that's one of the things he's struggled with. So it depends on the horse what your goals are. For me, for him, I was focused on building his stamina because we had already been doing the long mileage, but trying to fine tune all the muscles he's going to need to use. And it's still trial and error. Like, I went to different rides and discovered, like, the last ride I did at Laurel Mountain, we were in some deep sand and I did a 3-day, 150 mile ride. And day one, I was sure that we were going to pull and we weren't going to finish. And I wasn't going to do that full 150 because he got really sore in his shoulders. And rides like that, where you're going somewhere that isn't where you're used to conditioning and it's not similar to the terrain you're conditioning on, you find out things like, man, I'm not training in this deep sand. I didn't know that I don't have his shoulder muscles built up enough that he's going to get sore just for the first 10 miles, even though he's fully capable of doing 50 miles. So I think that the conditioning goals change constantly all the time that I couldn't really give you like a solid, this is my plan that I do for sure. And it always works, but it definitely helps that I am on an endurance ranch and I have some guidance where someone can tell me, this is your goal now. The goalpost is moved. This is what you should be doing.
Right. It's always an on ever-changing thing. Like, so what are you going to be doing for getting yourself and Jeepers heat acclimated?
Oh, well, we're so lucky to live in Southern California for that. Luckily, it's just hot enough already in April.
Uh-huh.
We could begin doing that. But we do have that training hill near where I live, and we're going to go up and down it quite a few times and station some water at the bottom and practice in the heat of the day. But luckily, like I also go for runs. I'm outside all the time. I'm used to being in the heat. It's adding that level of physical activity. And I mean, I've been asked this a lot, like how I'm preparing for Tevis, but both me and Jeepers have ridden the hottest section of Tevis. Like we've swept the canyons and Devil's Thumb, and during the heat of the day. And a couple of years ago, we were riding it when we had a horrible accident, and we were a part of trying to help get through that because that's what the sweep riders do. And so we were stuck there in the heat for a very long time. So a lot of this, like both being from Auburn and me being a part of Tevis so many years, I have experienced this, and so has my horse. We just haven't pieced it all together. Like we've been certain parts of the ride, but we've never done it. Like I haven't been in the hottest part of Tevis after we've already gone 50 miles. So that's something that a bridge that we kind of just have to cross when we get there. But I'm pretty confident both in our experience and where we live that the heat isn't a huge issue and pretty easy to train for.
Okay, so tell us, what are the qualifications for entering Tevis and how did you go about meeting them this year?
Yeah, so you have to get 300 competitive qualifying miles. So it doesn't mean just like go around in your backyard or on the beach and loop and loop and loop and ride 300 miles in a week. You have to go to AERC sanctioned competitions. And I know there are some other exceptions. I think that you can do some like FEI rides, and you can do, God, what is the name of the other association? The
NATRAC.
Yes, thank you.
Yes.
So you can do any of those sanctioned competitions, and they have to be rides that are 35 miles or more, 35 miles up. So you can't, it doesn't count if you do like an intro or limited distance ride. It definitely counts towards your personal goals, but it just does not count for your qualification for Tevis. And I only wanted to do 50s because that would be the quickest way to get up to 300. And I have already been riding long distance. I just hadn't been competing. And there were a lot of reasons why. It was work and financial reasons and time. And when I moved to this endurance ranch, part of my job was I was going to these rides with my ranch. So I should also be entering them. It just pushed me towards it. And I had so many people tell me, and I completely agree, if someone was starting to try to qualify for Tevis and they also hadn't been in any competitions, you shouldn't just start at a 50. You should at least go and do a limited distance and work your way up and see what your horse can do. But because I had been sweep riding at Tevis and I had that longer mileage that I was already doing like 25 mile rides, I was like, well, let's just do a 50. And if I don't complete it, then I don't complete it. And I know that we're not ready to do a 50, but why don't I just try it now? Again, absolutely wouldn't recommend that to anyone, but that's where I started. So I started at, and again, this was only 5 months ago because I had already been riding this distance, but I hadn't been entered in anything. So I started with a 50 mile competition, and that first ride, I did learn things because I was pulled at the 25 mile midway point. And I had learned that my horse will cramp up if he stands and doesn't move around too long. And the next 50 that I tried, we moved him. We had him constantly walking in circles and feeding him at the midway point. And we left, trotted out after 25 miles, and he was perfect. And since then, I had a system and it worked just fine. And about every month I was doing a 50, and I did a couple of them back to back. I had two catch horses, when, and that's when you use someone else's horse in a competition. And oftentimes it's either you lease or pay the owner, and you have to prove yourself as a rider. It is a complete trust thing. It's not like you can just go on a website and book a horse for one of these rides. But once you're in and you know people in that community, you can borrow horses. And I know a lot of riders who do only ride endurance rides on catch horses. You don't have to have your own at all. That's a completely new culture I was exposed to while doing this. So while Jeepers was resting, I did catch ride on a couple of others. And I did my final nail in the coffin for getting qualified for Tevis was I did at Laurel Mountain. I did a 3-day, 150-mile ride. Day one, I rode Jeepers. Day two, I rode Ron, which is one of the horses from our ranch. And day three, I rode Jeepers again. So I gave him a nice rest day in between. So Jeepers did do 100 miles, but he had a little bit of a break in between. And, you know, it's not really necessary for you to ride your own horse the entire time, because once you've proven yourself to be qualified for Tevis, they pretty much trust you that you can condition a horse up, and you don't qualify the horse, you just qualify the rider. So if I were to ride Tevis next year on a completely new horse that has never done any of that, that is at the discretion of me, someone who they trust to have been experienced enough to understand what it takes to condition a horse for Tevis. So I get a lot of questions, especially on social media, asking, well, if Jeepers didn't do all 300 of those miles, how do you know he can do Tevis? And you know, you don't know. You actually don't know, even in a horse that has done Tevis before, if you're going to pull or something's going to change. But I do know that I know what I'm doing at this point, and I do trust that I can condition him myself, because you can completely condition a horse without ever having to do any of those competitions. It's just a trust thing.
Right. And Jeepers has been over a lot of that trail, so you know he can do it.
Right.
Okay. So one more question. If you could go back and give your earlier self one piece of advice, what would it be?
You know, I don't believe in hindsight time travel. I think the best way to learn is to live something. And I think, like, that first competition that I did, that I pulled at 25 miles, yes, in hindsight, in the moment, I did spend my money and drive all the way out there. And I guess you could say I failed, because I did not realize that my horse would cramp up. And if someone just told me, walk him around in circles and keep him moving and you'll be fine, I could have completed that 50, and I would have had that 50 earlier. But I think, you know, with discretion, like, I don't think everyone should just, like, enter a ride completely blind, not knowing anything and not open to any kind of criticism or learn anything or ask any questions from anyone around them. But a lot of what we do is you just kind of have to show up and put in the work, and you learn from the rides itself. You ride your own ride. So I know people who have been doing endurance longer than I've been alive, and they learn something at every single ride. And it's one of those things that you absolutely have to be there to learn more about yourself and your horse. So genuinely, I don't think that I would tell myself anything.
You just got to go learn by doing. Right. And every horse is different. You know, it's like when I start a new horse after riding one for, you know, many years, it's like I'm brand new again at it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like a whole new learning experience. So I totally got you there. Exactly. Well, we want to wish you the best of luck to you and Jeepers on your Tevis adventure this summer, and all your other future endeavors. So thank you so much for joining us. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For first-time horse owners and new riders, finding the information and support you need can be challenging. That's why Equine Network has partnered with Sentinel and Absorbine to bring you My New Horse. From important horse keeping information and how-to videos to social media communities, exclusive experiences, and more, My New Horse is your one-stop shop for riders of all levels and disciplines looking for easy-to-understand horse care information and guidance. Start your horse ownership journey today. Visit MyNewHorse.com.
Well, if you're interested in the sport of endurance, go visit AERC.org and look up the ride calendar to find rides near you or endurance clinics so you can go and learn more.
Dun, dun, dun. And there is also the NATRC. I think you call it NATRAC. If they don't have a lot of rides in your local area, and believe it or not, there are some parts of the country that don't have a lot of AERC rides, that is an alternative. Their ride program is slightly different. It does have additional skill sets that you are not required to have for AERC. So check into it. So that's an alternative for folks who can't get to AERC rides. And we will see you again next month on the second Tuesday, Karen.
Terrific. Everybody have a good ride and be safe out there.